Welcome to The B-Side, a podcast that engages thinkers, mostly sociologists, at the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, and much more. We're your hosts,
Corey Fields
and Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University. Before we move on, yet again, since this is just our second episode, I just want to talk a little bit more about our name, The B-Side. You know, B is in Black, but we're also a spinoff of The Annex, and in the music world, back in the day, artists would release a single, and on the A side of the LP would be what they thought would be the hit, and on the B side, the secondary recording. Well, we're here on the B side to let you know that we are second to nobody, but we love the name. So, as such, this episode will feature one of our favorite B-side recordings. In this episode, we have Terrence Trent D'Arby's Greasy Chicken as part of the intro. Dig that funk? You know, little known fact, Terrence Trent D'Arby's name is no longer Terrence Trent D'Arby. It is now Fernando Francesco Mitrea.
So that's what happened to Terrence Trent D'Arby. He went away. He's somebody else now. So I should be Googling Sananda to find all the latest hits.
I wouldn't hold my breath on that, Corey, but that perhaps this is what occurred. Well, joining us today are our guests, Tamara Mose from Brooklyn College and Brandi Summers from Virginia Commonwealth University. Tamara is the author most recently of The Playdate, Parents, Children, and the New Expectations of Play and Raising Brooklyn, Nannies, Children, and Caribbeans, Creating Community, both from NYU Press. And her most recent project is on professional Black women and their relationship to food and sex, two of my favorite things. And Brandi Summers is joining us, as I said, from VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University. Brandi is the author most recently of the article in QED, a journal of GLBTQ world making called Black as Aesthetic, The Politics of Vision, Visibility, and Visuality in Vogue Italia's A Black Issue. And her recent book manuscript, Black in Place, The Spatial Aesthetics of Race in a Post-Chocolate City, is under contract with UNC Press. Tamara, Brandi, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, so let's just jump right into it. Tamara, you win the coin toss because Mose comes before Summers in the alphabet. So Tamara, let's talk about your work a little bit.
Well, I'll take you through my trajectory, actually. So in my first book, the Raising Brooklyn book, where I talk about nannies, they're Caribbean nannies, I provide a framework for understanding how social spaces are shaped by West Indian babysitters who move between public and private places in gentrified Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And I kind of look at how their identities are reconstructed through these spaces and the meanings that they create in their everyday. So really looking at how do these sitters move from a private sphere of the employer, their white employers, and then how are they perceived when they move across public spaces? And then how do they actually operate on a day-to-day basis in public spaces? And what I found is that public spaces really act as a refuge from the private sphere, where they feel isolated and where they feel even more surveilled than they are in public spaces. So that's the first book. The second sole-authored book that I did is The Playdate. And in that book, I kind of wanted to understand how is it that we went from children going outside and knocking door to door and asking children, hey, you want to come out and play? To all of a sudden having some kind of privatized play where there's a set time, a set location, usually at one of the parents' homes, where children can play. And what I found through interviewing several parents about this playdate phenomenon is that parents were excluding certain types of children through the privatization of play. So I was really curious about that and interested in how it is that we do privatize play, meaning what kinds of foods are we giving these children? Who's being excluded and why are they being excluded? Is it because of behavioral temperaments that they are displaying out in the public sphere? And then how does that look different when you bring them into the private sphere? So that was the second book. In that second book as well, I look at how parents use race, food, and discipline and class as criteria by which to judge other parents and subsequently their children. as well looking at how the play day contributes to inequality that actually does play out in society. And then also looking at this missed opportunities to discuss different household rules or income or inequality that you may have if you had more diverse friends joining you for play. So those are really the two books that I've already published. The next book is on food and sex, which we're all excited about. I have no clue what I'm finding yet, but what I am looking at are professional women, usually between the ages of 25, and I think the oldest member I have is 65 years of age, looking at how these professional women negotiate food and sex or have a relationship to food and sexual intimacy. But how do they internalize certain tropes? So I'm looking at the hypersexualized Black body. I'm looking at the welfare queen as well as the strong Black woman to see if when Black women, professional women, internalize these tropes, do they influence somehow the relationship to food and sexual intimacy? And so that's where I am now currently with that particular research.
So Tamara, what made you segue into food and sex other than they're great?
I think what is interesting about food and sex is that certain people believe that they are both natural drives that we have in terms of needing sex and needing food for survival. So I'm kind of interested in how that plays out among Black professional women. And Black professional women, the reason I chose that particular group is simply because that voice is not around in the literature. We don't see that voice often in the literature as it pertains to sexual intimacy and food. So I wanted to bring those voices to the fore by looking at these two entities. But I really just wanted to explore this idea of we have these natural drives, or are they actually socially constructed? And then seeing how do they actually move through society and their everyday lives with these two things at play constantly within their lives. So that's actually how I came to it.
It reminds me, jumping in here, I'm thinking of is Avril Clark. Is that inequality of love? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it reminds me of her book. And one of the things I loved about her book was sort of the argument that we should sort of shift our thinkings around inequalities, around romance and sex and marriage,
right?
Not as thinking about those, not as differences, but as inequalities, right? And like in the way that we care about income inequalities or wealth inequalities, mm-hmm. that this is an important inequality that matters. And I can't help but wonder, I'll be very curious to hear more about this project as you sort of move forward with it. But I wonder if like inequalities in romance get offset maybe by relationship to food. I mean, I guess I'm so just sort of thinking about what this relationship between, the intersection. So like, if there's like a, I don't know, romance inequality or sex inequality, like do people use, does food become like a pathway, not to, I don't know, make up for it, but like.
To satiate that drive, you think?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something like that. I don't know. I'm just sort of babbling. I'm also very curious. I'm like, I would love to read the chapter about the intersection between foods and I'm like, how do I understand? Where does the comma go in this?
Well, and you know, when I do talk about this research, I have to be very clear. It's not food for sex. It is food and sex. So I'm not necessarily clear. I'm coding the data right now. I'm not seeing necessarily an intersection between the two as it relates to any one individual. But I think what I am seeing is that people do speak about both entities in a similar way in terms of craving, in terms of experimentation, in terms of what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. So, you know, there's definitely a social component to this, and that's what I'm teasing out right now to see if there is an actual intersection or are these two parallel entities that we're talking about.
I wonder, Tamara, are professional women more likely than their non-professional counterparts to be more adventurous as far as food goes and maybe less adventurous as far as sex goes? Or are they Do you think that they're just more adventurous, period? And I'm thinking in part specifically about Black women professionals.
In terms of the food, what I noticed in the literature is that when we're talking about working class folks and their relationship to food, they see it more as utilitarian, right? So it's as much food as you can get for the least amount of cost that is going to feed the entire family. Very utilitarian. And I mean, I think most people think in that way. With the Black professional women, many of them single, obviously, and we could go into the literature about that. But a lot of them were single. A lot of them were experimental and like to try new things because a lot of them are eating out as well. So not as many as you would think are cooking at home. They are eating out. Whereas when you're looking at working class folks, they're not eating out at restaurants every night. They are cooking at home and they're typically cooking these one pot meals or several dishes, but in an economical way. And it's, again, not adventurous. It is either their cultural food or just standard American food that they are going to eat night after night, and they eat several leftovers night after night. With the Black professional women, many of them don't eat leftovers or they're eating out at sit-down restaurants. In terms of adventurous in bed, it kind of varies. And again, I'm coding the data now, so I'm not too sure what the numbers are on this because it's in its infancy stage. But some women are very adventurous. And what I noticed is that several women who have had some type of sexual trauma early on in their lives tended to be more sexually adventurous than those who did not. So that's something I'm curious about.
Huh. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's also like thinking about these, the category of adventurous, right? Like feels like in some way relational. Because I have to guess that many of the Black professional women, like there was a trajectory into the middle class, right? So they didn't necessarily grow up middle class, but became middle class through education and job or whatever. And obviously some people probably have always been middle class, but I would guess around the food stuff, there are probably a lot of things that like in their middle class networks and circles read as adventurous, but they just like grew up eating it. If not, you know, in the way that like ethnic food or, you know, Black food gets coded as adventurous and exotic in certain contexts. And the like, what would read to them is like, oh, this is what, you know, this my grandma cooked.
Right.
This is what we ate.
Right.
Sort of reads as like, ooh, it's like super exotic or adventurous to like their, you know, coworkers or whatever, or maybe friends they made in college. So it's, yeah, it's actually
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about what you just said is I have this subsection of participants who are all from the South, and so I mean their food that they are rejecting now because they're older, they know more about nutrition because they're a little more educated now. They are rejecting actually their home cooked food, and I think for people up north, we might consider that a little adventurous, right? Having the smothered mac and cheese and the fried chicken and, you know, soul food. Soul food has a name for a reason. And when you know that you're going to a soul food restaurant, you get excited because it's something different than maybe what you eat every day. But that was the norm for them growing up. And now they're actually rejecting that.
I have a working hypothesis. I'll be curious to hear once you finish coding the data. Are like the people who are rejecting soul food for like whatever nutrition health reasons, are they having a supplement that lost a soul with more sex?
That's very interesting. I'll have to let you know about that. We'll see.
Yeah, well, that sounds great, Tamara. I can't wait. I cannot wait for this book to come out. I cannot wait.
Thank you.
Okay, so Brandy, why don't we talk about you and your work?
Sure. So I generally, in terms of my work, I look at the aesthetic function of race and the ways that representations of Blackness have been used to produce spaces. So you mentioned in the intro, I'm working on my book manuscript, but then also I recently published an article on fashion. So on the one hand, I look at urban spaces, and the other hand, I look at fashion. So I kind of use both of those to think through how Blackness is aestheticized. For the book, I'm looking at how aesthetics and race really converge to map Blackness in Washington, D.C. I'm looking at a specific neighborhood, the 8th Street Northeast Corridor, which is now kind of the gentrified name is the Atlas District. And I'm explaining how really D.C. generally, but then also if we think about other urban metropolises, shift from chocolate cities to these cosmopolitan spaces. I'm also thinking about how race has been really weaved into this kind of symbolic reimagining of historic commercial districts like 8th Street. And like I said, thinking about how race is aestheticized, but also how Blackness is organized in different ways to subtly transform the space. I really kind of focus more on kind of these everyday actions and everyday kind of quotidian ways that development uses race to shift our imaginations of how to understand Blackness and how to understand space. So that means, you know, I got to talk about gentrification, but instead of really going into it generally, I'm looking at different practices of gentrification and how they're tied up in aesthetic conventions and influence how we actually see the space and the function of folks within it. And so for that, I have to really see, again, Blackness as an aesthetic that can be attached to Black bodies, but that's also present in, you know, objects, performances, and languages. And then also thinking about how we can imagine the deployment of Blackness as a result of this historically situated kind of aesthetic formation. And so for that book, it's really kind of made me think a lot about themes of like surveillance and understanding, again, development and urban planning and how we have these stories about these chocolate cities that are now becoming these kind of diverse meccas and what that really means to not only the Black bodies that have been there, but also kind of the Blackness that their bodies really kind of elicited in the public sphere. In terms of the fashion stuff, so for the article, I'm really thinking about how Black bodies in the image. So not necessarily those who are walking down the runway, but specifically in terms of editorial images. So I looked at the 2008 issue, it was a July 2008 issue of Vogue Italia, where they had all Black women across the diaspora as the models in the issue. And it was celebrated by so many people because it was a big deal to have this major publication really include a lot of Black models. But at the same time, it was really drawing on this kind of Obama moment. It was drawing on our ideas of post-racial, and it was also published in the context of other editorials where, you know, models were wearing Obama t-shirts. And but also at the same time, you're having models, white models continue to have blackface or wearing afros, et cetera. So I'm really thinking about how we can not necessarily look at this issue and celebrate it without some kind of critical commentary, but instead, mm-hmm. if we imagine ways to queer our understanding of Blackness in order to produce a form of Blackness that's not just celebrating this iconic beauty or classic beauty, but instead kind of disrupt that idea.
Well, so, you know, Brandy, so in thinking about both of those two projects, right? So I was thinking about the Vogue Italia, you know, so, you know, I have two copies still in plastic because I'm like, those are going to be collector's items because this is never going to happen again.
All right, Grandma.
So it's interesting, right? So you have this celebration of Blackness, right? Mm-hmm. In this one episode, in this one issue, yeah. this one volume. And then you fast forward and we still have these practices of, you know, of the absence of Blackness,
right?
The subsequent issues. And this kind of reminds me of, you know, the kerfluffle that's going on with National Geographic right now, right? Their race issue that just came out. I wonder if that's also going to just turn into, okay, this is our mea culpa moment. Mm. This is going to become a collector's item. And then we're never going to revisit this issue again. So that's one connection. The second, in thinking about the two, is these very specific ways in which Blackness is totally curated. I mean, we've had this conversation before, the curating of Blackness for profit, for specific aesthetic effect, right? Only to then have like all real sort of presence of Blackness, right, that deviates from that, like in future, like sort of just vanish and go away.
No, absolutely. And I think that's why for me, it was important to think about what Blackness meant as an aesthetic, rather than thinking about it as identity, something that you invest in, something that has been developed by history alone, right? If we think about the ways that the Blackness that our bodies register are used as part of a market to sell things, right? So it's not, it really, of course, has this connection throughout a variety of different industries. The most recent National Geographic's a great example because, you know, we saw Black folks weren't shocked to see those two sisters, right? To know that they could be twins. That's the issue you're talking about, right? So for other people, it's just this, oh my goodness, to represent different colors. We have to recognize, you know, diversity is by skin color, but you have to kind of have a Black body in the frame in order for people to acknowledge diversity. And so there are ways still that Blackness has value to add diversity to the mix and make everything okay. While, like you said, Black women, I mean, Black children, Black men, Black boys are devalued in terms of their actual personhood, their beings, but the Blackness that their bodies, again, register is really important and can actually be traded and can be used and can be worn and can be consumed in a variety of ways.
So, Brandy, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and actually I think it does link both strands of your work, right, is this notion of commodification of Blackness. But I'm particularly interested in the urban context, right? So one of the things, have you found in your work that there's a difference in terms of what happens when sort of Blackness is marketed as part of like, I don't know, like gentrification or sort of like urban renewal to Black people versus white people? Because one, this is something I noticed. When I lived in Chicago, I felt like there was a lot of like, let's, you know, mobilize and like, you know, rejuvenate Bronzeville, middle-class Black people. And like, let's return this to its glory of like a proud Black neighborhood. But that was really different than like racially inflected gentrification that I saw when I lived in San Francisco. And even here in DC, where it's like, this Black history happened here, and here's like a sign and like a walking tour, but the people who are moving into the neighborhoods are white, right? And so I'm just curious if there's like a difference in terms of the content of the Blackness that's leveraged for white audiences, say, compared to like Black audiences consuming Blackness, or is that something, I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does. I think it's one of those things that I've found there is this desire for a nostalgic idea of Blackness, especially in places like Chicago. The Bay Area is a little different. I'm from the Bay Area, so I'm very familiar with what goes on there. But other if you think about areas of the South, and sometimes too in D.C., there's this way that, you know, Blackness represented something very positive in terms of communities, of course, that were formed because of segregation and all these other tactics and structural inequalities that kind of built the communities. But there's a way we want to look back positively. And that's where you find people wanting to celebrate certain heroes. That's certainly happening here in Richmond with Maggie Walker being celebrated. Or Henry Box Brown, right? So I think that, and just like what you said, there's a way that Blackness is used differently by white people or kind of the powers that be, whether it be in terms of producing a mural or the names of restaurants or things like that. Where I'm most interested is kind of that everyday component.
Okay.
How literally the bodies on the street kind of provide some kind of currency for this gentrification. And so what you might assume is that with gentrification and displacement that there's a way that Black bodies are ushered away from the street and that you don't want to see them. But at least in DC and in the area where I'm looking, there seems to be this investment in having Black people there because, again, it makes folks feel good. Like, we didn't displace everybody. See, they're on the
street. Right.
Now, they may not necessarily be able to buy a home in the area or shop mm-hmm. in the area, but as long as they're there, that means that we're a diverse community, that we're listening right. to the needs of everyone there. But there's certainly been research that's talked about the ways that Black folks in particular have kind of focused on this nostalgic, and I'm not going to say inaccurate, but it's certainly generous revisionist history of what it was right. like in Bronzeville.
Right. I'm thinking about Jim Crow nostalgia, Michelle Boyd.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there are sociologists, anthropologists, geographers, and others who have really been kind of thinking about this, specifically Michelle's book, though. So, yeah.
Tamara.
Yeah. I was just wondering, Brandy, if the Black body is constant in these public spaces that you speak of and in these neighborhoods and communities, do we lose identity? And this could be either psychologically or socially. Do we lose identity in knowing that the aesthetic Blackness that you speak of has a limited shelf life? So when you talk about this idea that we know these covers, these magazine covers, it's going to happen once or twice and that's it. And then we know that there's going to be this big gap in between, similar to Black Panther coming out, you know, there's all this hype and it's the largest grossing comic movie. And we know, okay, so we're going to be on hiatus now for the next decade, right? And so I'm just wondering, is there any sense that Black folks lose identity in knowing that there is this limited shelf life to all of these things?
You know, I don't think it's a matter of losing identity. So just as much as I'm talking about Blackness as an aesthetic that mm-hmm. is used by white folks and institutions, et cetera, mm-hmm. Black people invest in a certain Black aesthetic or a Blackness as an aesthetic in the same way. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that means that we have this loss of a tie to our history or culture or mm-hmm. different values that really we attribute to being Black. Now, when it comes to, you're right, when we see, we get super thrilled about Black Panther, right? Mm-hmm. We are super thrilled, just like, you know, in the 80s, seeing the Cosbys on television, right. Like everyone was thrilled about that. It didn't matter, except all that mattered was that you saw a Black person on television, right? Or a Black right. Indian on television, despite the fact that they absolutely did not represent the norm or didn't, you know, if we think about kind of the heteronormative ways that they, we know what we're talking about, but
it was not a real representation.
Exactly. It was not a real representation. And so we're actually invested in these images of Blackness that make us feel good, but particularly because we haven't actually seen alternatives. So what I really kind of want us to think about, especially as it has to do like with this Vogue Italia issue, is that we need structural change. We don't need to just be happy based on what we're seeing, right? We need to disrupt. We need to make things weird and strange, and even for ourselves, like not clear, right? Because we can't get super thrilled about positive when we're invested in a certain positive that's definitely exclusive too.
Are you an Afro pessimist there, Brandy?
Sometimes.
I know. We might have to do like
Afrofuturism, but it's kind of like, well, it's complicated. Yeah. So
we're going to have to do like a glossary of terms for some of our melanin challenged listeners. Like, what does that mean? Afrofuturist, Afropessimist.
This has just been great. Okay. So now that we have established your brilliance and your bona fides and your areas of expertise, I think we're going to just launch into what's been going on over the past few weeks. Okay. And Corey, why don't you choose the first topic and get us through it?
Well, it seems like, yeah, so there's so much to choose from. I guess the thing I've been, well, I guess, do we want to go in terms of like order? Because the most recent thing it seems like we have to talk about, certainly as a DC resident, would be the marches from the past weekend, right? Growing out of the Parkland shooting in Florida, but not un- I would say, like, the organizers have done, I guess, a noble effort, right? A good effort of trying to link it to a broader discussion around gun violence in the United States. So, the big march is here. As a relatively new resident to DC, there have been like a bunch of just like march kind of things happening, and I'm sort of adjusting, getting used to this. But this was a big one. And you saw it, you know, all over, people all over the city, heading to the march, leaving the march. It definitely, the, you know, the physical space of DC felt altered on Sunday, I have to say. So what'd you guys, I mean, you guys have any thoughts about the march, what they're standing up for? I guess we could also talk about sort of fallout from it.
Absolutely. I loved seeing our youth bringing together various generations of Americans and immigrants alike to fight an oppressive system of violence. That was beautiful to see. Hearing the speeches of Naomi Wadler, who placed a spotlight dead on the need for us to see gun violence as an intersectional issue. Uh-huh. Emma Gonzalez, who gave that powerful pause for just over 6 minutes for us to contemplate just how long the Parkland students suffered. And others who made clear that Black folks have been talking about this for years. And we need to listen. We need to listen. That whole speech from all of these young folks, it was just so powerful. And, you know, by the way, can I just say it was really frustrating to see the intersectionality at the march, yet the Washington Post chose a cover photo of only white children this week. And what a slap in the face. I mean, everyone was talking about this need for intersectionality, and you know, the media is still only showing white tears. And I thought it was just a slap in the face. But what people tend to forget entirely is that we're discussing gun violence and gun reform. The masses want better background checks on purchases. They want insurance on a deadly weapon in the same way we do with cars, age requirements that are equivalent to those of drinking age. And when I hear the rhetoric of some who suggest that this is a ploy to take guns away entirely, I mean, I have to laugh at how obvious it is that they don't know how to listen. No one is saying, take your guns away. People are saying, we need more accountability with deadly weapons. How is this not reasonable? Is the question that often goes into my head is, how is this not reasonable? And if you want to, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you want to protect yourself, follow a stricter protocol. There's absolutely no reason for someone to own an AR-15 weapon. It certainly isn't for hunting. And it's certainly not made to kill an intruder. It's specifically made to kill masses of people. And so it just boggles my mind.
Yeah, so two of the things that I thought about in connection to this is, number one, I think one of the things that we don't really talk about is the connection between between the proliferation of guns in U.S. society and what we think of as police brutality and you know, and the shooting of unarmed Black folk, Black and brown folk. Right. And I actually believe that because there are so many guns, you have police are shook, right? Mm-hmm. And police expect that you're going to have a gun, right? Regardless of whether or not you have a gun. And I think that that's probably one of the reasons why police are trained the way that they are. And basically, it just turns into open season on unarmed folk out there in the street. I actually think that if we were able to control the proliferation of guns in society, I actually think that we'd actually see fewer incidences of innocent men and women being killed by police. And the second thing is, oh my goodness, I was listening to the pundits on Sunday, which I do every Sunday, even though I don't want to kill myself afterwards. And, you know, and listening to people like Rick Santorum and other people who seem to believe, like, they are taking the example of the shooting that just happened just outside of DC here in Maryland recently. You know, a young man comes in. He's basically coming in to shoot his ex-girlfriend. He shoots her, she was 16, and a 14-year-old young man. And then he gets taken down by a school safety officer. And they're saying, you see, if you have a good guy with a gun, then you get to stop a bad guy with a gun. They didn't stop the bad guy with a gun. He went there and he
did
shot.
His damage.
Exactly. He right. shot right. exactly who he wanted to shoot. Right? Mm-hmm. He got his mission done. And I just don't understand why people just can't think rationally about this issue. Brandy.
It's so actually ridiculous that I don't even think it has to do with logical thinking. Because you're right, that makes no sense. Or the idea that you can stop guns with more guns. It really doesn't make any sense. So there has to be something else behind it. I refuse to believe that they can't figure out that that is faulty logic. And also speaking to, you know, how Black bodies are still criminalized. And in thinking about social justice, or at least the need for it, we don't think about Black people as the victims of crimes, but as the primary yeah. offenders. Mm-hmm. And so there's this fear that's still produced by Black bodies that has a huge population of people still saying that they need to hold on to their guns to protect themselves. And so with the march, I agree, it was beautiful to see so many, a cross-section of young children and also teenagers and young adults and their parents and grandparents coming out. But what we also realized, in order to have some kind of movement, like with the Post, you need white children on the cover right. in order to really elicit some kind of emotion or people to actually take action in something. So,
yeah. And I think, I mean, sort of linking back to something Brandy just said, but also Leslie said at the beginning of her comment, I think partly Blackness looms over this conversation in a way that we certainly haven't included in the national dialogue around this, because I do think it links together police shootings and, you know, gun ownership and like sort of a ramping up of gun ownership. But I'm not sure if it's in like police are shooting people because they think everybody has guns. I wonder if it's like a fear of Blackness that drives both those things, right? It's sort of what this sort of, I don't know, irrational fear is driving police shootings, partly grounded in like stereotypes and, you know, ungiven, unwarranted fear, but that's also the same thing that gets used to gin up gun sales, right? Like whether it's like fear of the Black criminal or fear of the Black president taking your guns away. Because I saw this thing recently and I can't remember where, so feel free to dismiss it as random Twitter garbage. But that like the, you know, when the talk of sort of, you know, gun control hits up, there's usually like a spike in gun sales, but like that hasn't happened this time, right? And like that would happen under Obama. Like there was like, oh, spike in gun sales because like fear Obama's going to take your guns. Mm-hmm. But this discourse now isn't driving that same sort of spike. And I don't know. I mean, I guess I just feel like, yeah, part of what's going on is, you know, this sort of fear of Black criminality, this manufactured fear, right, gets used and deployed to get people to buy more guns, but also simultaneously, like, lets police shooters off the hook, right? And what is striking is the extent to which we're able to have this conversation without really talking about that. And I do wonder to the extent that that gets marginalized when, you know, the Post doesn't only has white kids on the cover or whatever. Are we ever going to really be having the conversation around guns that we need to be having, right?
And I think the other issue with that, I think, is it is so easy to reduce all of this to an individual or to a certain group of people. And what we often gloss over are the structural constraints. So when we are talking about the NRA or we're talking about government laws that allow for certain structures to exist, even the policing laws that are structures that exist, we tend to gloss over that because that's not what the masses can consume. They don't want to consume that. They may not even have the capacity to consume that information in a real way. So it's often easy to reduce it to stereotypes and individual behaviors rather than looking at the greater scheme of things and how this is really just a manufactured replication of slavery.
And I also think, yeah, that like sort of legislators and lobbyists and sort of, you know, like professional political operators are probably more savvy about this than we give them credit for, right? And so like the sort of foolishness and illogical nature, seeming nature of the pro-gun arguments are partly meant to ramp the discussion up, like to heighten the discussion to like Second Amendment level versus like background checks, right? Which seem small and reasonable and like people are behind. But I'm sure there's a fear that, you know, the institution of those small checks are going to spread, right? Mm-hmm. So like, that's just the foothold. Right. You get that foothold in, and then it's going to like get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then next thing you know, there's going to be no guns. Now, mm-hmm. I think that's like an unreasonable concern and like seems highly unlikely. But I don't think it's completely crazy to think you want to, you know, cut it off at its foot. Like if you let universal background checks get in, the next thing you know, certain kind of guns are going to be banned. And then the next thing you know, only certain people are going to get to have them. So, it's sort of interesting to think about in that respect, too, as like political back and forth. I mean, but the, you know, the real, I think, end point here is that like, it's not just a political game, that these are people, like their lives at stake on this one. So it sort of operates differently than, say, you know, debates around the tax cut or whatever. Right. Which isn't to say that lives aren't at stake with tax cuts.
Well, you know, talking about political games, I think we're going to have to segue into our next segment. So, Stormy Daniels, did any of you see the 60 Minutes segment?
Clips of it.
Yeah, not in its entirety.
Clips of it, but I have to embarrassingly admit I read all the stuff beforehand,
right.
Like the Us Weekly interview. Right. So I know.
I mean, should we? I mean, should we care about this? I mean, is this just another piece of political theater that's meant to distract us from real issues, or is this a real issue?
I think we should care about Stormy Daniels. Why not? That's the kind of society we live in. Mm-hmm. I think what she's doing is she's corroborating a pattern in 45's treatment of women. I'm not convinced it'll move his base to see him with rational eyes or anything like that. But I do believe it has shaken some of his voters. Evangelicals who strongly believe he is still backing up his promises in terms of religious rights are so quick to overlook the constant misogyny by this man that they have publicly confirmed what Karl Marx has said all along, which is religion is the opium of the masses, right? If evangelicals believe that this misogyny can be overlooked because of some political gain through which they will reap benefits, they have power to overlook the abuses of all of their constituents, thereby certifying that this type of behavior is okay. Look, we have heard comments from his mouth. We have heard stories from many women's mouths and have seen him demean women on live television during debates. It really doesn't get much worse than that. I think the Stormy Daniels situation is merely another story to tack onto his already controversial presidency, but I'm not convinced that it alone will do any significant damage to his presidency, though it may do some damage to his marriage.
So I have a question. Well, first of all, I think that marriage has been damaged a long time. But I have a question, not to get into the nitty gritty of this or to be gross, but you know, I think a big part of the Trump narrative for a while has been how much of a germaphobe he is, and that's why he won't shake some people's hands and et cetera, et cetera. How much of a germaphobe are you if you're insisting on having unprotected sex with a porn star?
Allegedly.
I feel like it's not the edge of porn star shaming. Like, I don't think porn stars have more germs than anybody else.
I'm not saying that they do at all, right? But it's like his idea that certain types of people's hands, right, for whatever reason, and I think it's usually women's hands, he's like unwilling to shake, right? But he's willing to just jump in there with unprotected sex, right?
I mean, well, both those behaviors seem like they fit very nicely under the misogyny umbrella in my mind. Like, I don't see them as like sort of necessarily contradictory. But no, right. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess for me, the excluding sort of, the unprotected sex, the situation, so to speak, that's most compelling is actually the aftermath, like the affair aspect of it. Like, whatever. I mean, I guess whatever. I'm not interested in policing people's personal lives because I don't want nobody policing mine. But, like, I have been struck by the ham-fisted incompetence, like, buttressed by, like, a pretty powerful dose of, like, misogyny in terms of, like, bullying women after the fact with all this. It's shocking to me that they weren't better able to keep this under wraps. Like, that's what blows my mind, the incompetence.
Does it really, though?
Trying to keep it quiet. I have to say. It really, I mean, I'm shocked the new, I have to say, every time. Because I don't know. I want to believe in, like, a sort of technocratic government where there's, like, basic competence if, like, you're trying to pull off a scam.
I want him to come out at the end and just say he's punking us all. That's all I want.
No, I was going to say that, like, none of this should surprise us at this point in terms of what's been capped or things that haven't, because it doesn't seem to be moving the needle in any way. So it's as if he's the barometer. Like, he's telling us about ourselves. He is such he's a caricature. Mm-hmm. And it's really, like, to see the excuses that people make for him, it's telling us more about our society than anything at all. So I can't really get drawn into the actual activity. Like, what we're seeing is this backlash against a sex worker and a woman's voice being delegitimized because of her job, right? And so it doesn't matter that they had a relationship. It doesn't matter that, you know, he was married. It doesn't matter all these other things where people usually cast judgment. Instead, they're focused on her profession. And so, of course, it's going to have us think about how we view women, how we view sex workers, and kind of what that means in our society. So it's hard for me to follow what's going on because I'm not shocked anymore at all. And it seems that nothing will take him down. So let me just look more at society and how...
Nothing took down Clinton either, right? I mean, if we look at the legacy, nothing takes them down. Not when it comes to sex outside of marriage.
It'd be interesting. Right. Two things. Number one, it'd be interesting to, you know, in an alternate universe, if Hillary Clinton had won and she had a sex scandal, I wonder if there'd be like a huge difference in how a woman is able to deflect this versus a man. And number two, I wonder if Donald Trump will then say, you know what, I am going to actually walk on a Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and see what happens. So, because I think he knows nothing would happen. And on that note, I was hoping that we'd have so much more time to talk about so much more stuff, but time is up. It's been great talking to you, Tamar, and you, Brandy, and always having Corey here. So thank you very, very much, and keep us posted on your two book projects. Let us know when they're coming out.
Definitely.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show, guys. It's been awesome having you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, so you've been listening to The B-Side, a sociology podcast on the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, and materiality. Thanks to our guests, Tamara Mose from Brooklyn College and Brandy Summers from VCU for a great conversation. We'd also like to thank our young producers at Queens College, Anika Chowdhury and Joshua Vieira. The B-Side is part of the growing Sociocast podcasting empire. So check out our sister programs at sociocast.org. We're your hosts, Corey Fields and Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University. And to take us out, here's the A-Side to Greasy Chicken, what I think of as one of the most beautiful odes to love and longing from the 80s. Sign Your Name by...
Bye.
What's his name again, Corey?
Oh, we know him as Trent Darby.
Zendaya, Maitreya, Francesco, wherever you are, we love you. Until next time, bye.
Bye. Bye.